So today is August 6, 2014. Thanks, Rick. And let's see, I'm Rick Hansen. And last week, if you were here, I started exploring this territory that I want to keep pursuing. Sort of what I think about, the words I was using and the phrase was fighting the good fight. But what I mean is there's a lot of Dharma, a lot of teaching, especially in the early teachings of Buddhism about tranquility, letting go, non-attachment, renunciation, monasticism, and all the rest of that. And I think that's cool. But there's really not a lot of teaching about passion, ambition, drive, or competition with other people, or being in situations where your own legitimate interests that everybody would agree, yeah? It's a legitimate interest. You have the right to do that. It's going to have impact on other people. And how do we manage that process? How do we explore, in particular, starting last week, ethical impacts on other people? And I want to explore further along this territory, this interesting area where how do we practice and how do we build businesses, raise children, discipline children, speak truth to power, assert ourselves in relationships, say no, draw lines, unilaterally disengage from situations that other people would like us to continue being part of, for better or worse. You know, how do we do all that while, as I've put it, staying in the green zone, staying centered with a mind, you know, relatively free of the poisons the Buddha talked about of hatred, greed, and delusion, or maybe a modern update could be fear and anger, the poisons of fear and anger, or frustration and disappointment or an addiction, or the poisons of envy, loneliness, or shame. All right, how do we do that? Okay? So last week I kind of focused on the side of ethical impacts in terms of our relationships with other people that were more on the side of encouraging assertiveness and full self-expression. And I talked about some guidelines in that regard, such as recognizing that the golden rule is a two-way street. In other words, that we are allowed to do unto ourselves as we would do unto others. In other words, we are allowed to claim for ourselves the rights and the opportunities and the freedoms that we would grant to other people. That's a principle of justice. Another factor on the encouragement of assertiveness from last week, and I record these talks if you want to go back and listen to that one, is the principle of unilateral action, that it really is okay fundamentally to act unilaterally. One of the really clear teachings in Buddhism is the principle of inheriting the results of one's own actions, for better or worse, or to use the term karma, which some have described as hitting golf balls in a shower, all right, for better or worse, right? And if there's no principle of individual karma, individual inheritance of results of one's actions, you can't have any kind of differentiation. So if there is this principle, we must have some capacity to act unilaterally, whether they like it or not, as long as, of course, our actions are within the frame of wholesome ends pursued with wholesome means. So that was the second guideline, unilateral action. And then the third guideline, will come to me, which is the ways in which it's okay to ask people to keep their agreements, tacit and explicit. Obviously, there are pitfalls around getting righteous about that, or holding people to the second, and getting intense needlessly and so forth. But in my personal experience, for every one person who's just way uptight about holding other people to every second of every agreement, there are lots and lots of people who somehow don't feel entitled deep out inside to just name it when other people establish understandings with them or make commitments, make promises, make agreements, that any reasonable person would go, yeah, that was our joint understanding, and then go, boom, drop the ball. And yet, it's so common that we don't say a word about it, and then that becomes the new norm, the new normal. So those are some of the things I explored on the side of assertiveness. Now I want to explore some factors in terms of ethical impact on the side of restraint. and explore the counterintuitive idea that what's called sila in the traditional language of Buddhism, translated in various ways as restraint, or maybe a more general term would be virtue, morality, in a wholesome sense, that sila, one of the three great pillars of practice, virtue alongside concentration and mindfulness, as well as wisdom. Those are the three, virtue, mindfulness, and wisdom. That virtue, paradoxically, empowers us. That restraint, morality, empowers us to pursue our wholesome ends with wholesome means, even if that can have impacts on other people. So I want to go through kind of quickly to sort of name some of the sort of, I think, basically 10, or no, 11. I'm going to name 11 fundamental guidelines in terms of the do's and don'ts of virtue. Not that virtue reduces, not that sila reduces to just these 11, but they're fairly clearly stated, and they're interesting to practice in terms of. So what you might want to do is think about a particular situation where you feel frustrated or like with other people especially, or you feel particularly kind of inhibited or you're not sure what to do or you're looking for some guidance. And think about that situation in terms of these guidelines, which I'll go through quickly and then we can really kind of talk about it, okay? So the first collection, the five guidelines, are under the general heading of the so-called five precepts. And these are expressed in a very important way. For some people, this will be just a review of what you already know. For others, perhaps, it might be new and interesting. These precepts, or admonitions, or guidelines, are not expressed as moral commandments. They are expressed as trainings that we undertake for the sake of our own awakening and for the benefits for other people. And the idea being that if we are to be free, it's and open-hearted and loving, it's important to not have a mind afflicted with guilt, and instead have a mind with what the Buddha called the bliss of blamelessness. Isn't that a lovely phrase? The bliss of true blamelessness. So these precepts are typically expressed in the negative as not this, not that. Thich Nhat Hanh and others have played around with formulations of these that are more affirmative rather than don't. They're framed as do's. You might want to explore that. But I'll just talk about them as it's been handed down to us from 2,500 years ago. So the first is, I undertake the training precept not to kill or not to take life. It's a whole collection of conversations about, is it okay to eat meat or animal products that are given to us, especially if they're given to us. The Buddha's pretty clear about don't go around, killing animals and then eating them. But if you participate in a larger process in which meat is served, is that okay, yes or no? There's a lot of discussion about that. Let's try to keep it focused here on our relationships with other human beings just for simplicity. But the first precept again is essentially thou shalt not kill. Okay, I undertake the training precept not to kill. Second is, I undertake the training precept not to take that which is not freely offered, not to steal. I find this one's very interesting because what do you do when you're walking by somebody who's writing in their diary, okay, and maybe you even catch a really inflammatory word like sex or, theft or something, and you just want to read it as you go by? Is that freely offered? It gets very interesting, what's freely offered and what's not freely offered. In other words, I undertake the training precept not to steal, as you construe that. The second one is I undertake the training precept not to harm myself and others or not to abuse sexuality. That's interesting. Again, where is the abuse line and where is it not, including self-harming? Because these precepts are directed toward oneself as well as to others, in effect. Okay? The fourth precept is I undertake the training precept not to speak falsely, not to lie. Okay? Again, you can explore is it false speech to name the truth but leave some parts out, skillfully or not? Right. So it's an exploration. I'm going to talk about wise speech momentarily. That's the other six. I'm going through the five precepts, then I'm going to go through the six criteria or aspects of wise speech. Okay? Then, a very interesting one, I undertake the training precept not to use intoxicants. And then there's a question on whether there's an escape hatch here. Okay? And I've pursued this with scholars of the Pali original language of Buddhism, so it's interesting. So one framing of this is I undertake the training precept not to use, and sometimes it's traditional language, wines, liquors, and other intoxicants, including psychoactive drugs, which were available in the Buddha's time. So I undertake the training precept not to use intoxicants, for they cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. There's no escape hatch in that translation. For they cloud the mind and use and lead to heedlessness. Or the other way it's languaged is, I undertake the training precept not to use intoxicants that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. And there are many practitioners of what we fondly call the upper middle way who are very fond of that form, that translation. So let your conscience be your guide, and also think about what are intoxicants. Classically, we of course have drugs, alcohol, stuff like that. But what about, the intoxication of power? Or the intoxication of caffeine, getting revved up? Or, this is an interesting one, you may know that Carl Jung had a term called inflation, which is a very interesting psychological state. Often it comes after releasing something, and it feels like, wow, this is great. There's a realization, there's a release, there's a sense of, wow, everyone's love, and sure, let's just do that. Why not? And we get a little carried away. It's kind of subtle. Or the subtle intoxications of, as I said about power, roles in which we're the teacher, or we're the knower, or we're the one who's more skillful, or we're the leader. Is that an intoxication we should be careful about? So that's for us to explore in our training. Not in a moralistic commandment, thou shalt not sin, or beware the consequences, but more, hey, what are the effects of, undertaking these precepts? And if we blow it, and we often do perhaps, we wake up and we go, okay, I undertake this again. Okay? Those are the five, now wise speech. You may be familiar with the Buddha's criteria for wise speech. It's very practical guidance, wise speech or right speech. And basically there are five conditions, and then there's a desirable but optional one. Okay? So the five are wise speech, skillful speech. And again, be thinking about this relationship, or situation, or family, or business, or general pursuit in life, and how it might actually serve you in your self-expression, your assertiveness, the full self-actualization, the wholesome self-actualization of yourself, or healing. How it might actually serve you to conduct yourself with others in terms of speech that is well-intended, that's number one, true, timely. God, I'm blanking on one. So true, timely, not harsh. That's an important one. What?
Is it wanted?
I'll get to that one. It's my back that's hurting. That's my back. Otherwise, I would know. Well intended, true.
Not gossip.
That's for the monks. We'll go there. Not harsh. It'll come to me. Not harsh. Timely. I'll come to another one. And well chosen. Probably wanted. 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 That's the optional one. Wanted. Okay. So is it true? Is it well intended? Right. Is it helpful? That's the one. Is it timely? Is it not harsh? Harsh is a very interesting word. Is this harsh? Ready? One, two, three. Is that harsh? Think of all those little noises we make, or that little eye roll, you know, or really? You know, what's the line on harsh? Okay? We tend to know it when we see it in our adolescents or teenagers, but what about looking in the mirror for ourselves? Right? And then ideally, wanted. Okay? So those are the six characteristics. Well-intended, helpful, true, not harsh, timely, and ideally wanted. Okay? So those are the big 11. That's kind of like the kind of quick summary, the do's and don'ts, the short one. How about your thoughts about that? Situations that this might apply, judgment calls, nightmare scenarios, in-laws. You know, you've heard me joke, Jean-Paul Sartre said, hell is other people, all right? That hell that is other people. So what do you think about all that, including in terms of supporting self-expression and your own assertiveness and kind of freeing you to really just swing out and move out with the bliss of blamelessness? Tom.
I was just going to say, I've had a recent experience where I felt that I needed to say something to my wonderful partner, and she was away on vacation, and I was really stewing about this issue. You know, I needed to get this on the table with her. It was a commitment that had not been met. And
she hadn't kept an agreement or something.
She hadn't kept an agreement, yeah. In my view.
Yeah.
And I talked to another individual about it, a trusted person, a friend, and she came home, and I haven't said anything. And I've just let it, not that I'm not going to address it, it's just that when you brought up timeliness, it was an interesting twist because I've seen my whole perspective on it change in forestalling saying anything.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Tom's talking about being kind of timely and restrained. What makes you feel that this is the wisdom of timeliness as opposed to the unwisdom of, you know, muzzling yourself? How do you tell the difference?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'm not afraid to speak my mind.
That's an important clue. You're not afraid. You're making this choice not out of fear.
Right. And it does need to be addressed at some point, but I'm in a much better state now to address it, and there's no urgency. So that's just a recent experience about timeliness and is it wanted.
Thank you. And a way I would just sort of build on what Tom said is the idea of choosing your spots, picking your battles. That's a familiar notion. And I think the wisdom in a lot of situations where we deliberately let it go, we deliberately, in effect, lose battles to win wars. Sorry about the martial metaphors and all the rest of that. But you know what I mean? We realize I don't need to deal with all that. I can let it go. Where I see that a lot in interaction, partly because I'm a couples counselor and been married a long time, relationships are built from interactions. A lot of research shows that. And interactions are built from turns, back and forth, like tennis in a way. Or at Tarnay's house, ping pong. Sign me up. Okay? And it's very interesting. So let's say you communicate with somebody, you say something, you hit the ball over the net, you may not hit it perfectly, but you hit it sort of reasonably, and they hit it back like, whoa! And there's a lot of stuff in it. Okay? Now what do you do with what comes back at you? I think of it metaphorically in various ways as like a mosaic coming back at you, or a big bag of stuff coming back at you over the tennis net. Just go with me here in the metaphor. And the question is, what do you respond to? Do you respond to the tone? Do you respond to this inflammatory word they dropped in? Or do you respond to the one thing that you can maybe actually join with? All right? And then it's a choice. Maybe sometimes you say, hey, time out. We're done if you talk to me like that. you know, I'm got to, you know, like, or something. Okay, maybe you make that choice. Other times, you let those inflammatory comments go by, those exaggerations, or these kind of bizarre ways they defend themselves, and instead of getting all into it on that, and I've just seen what often happens, right? You hit it across the net, they respond, and there's something that just inflames you, or me. And then I'm going to go after that one thing. I didn't like that word, or how dare they, or, you know, that was BS, or are you kidding me? And then I go after that, and then they go after my response to their response, and then we've spun out, and, well, wait a second, what was that original topic on the table, like when we put the kids to bed, or will we ever have sex again, or is it time to buy a new car? Like, you know, like, whoa, we're over here. And frankly, I think a lot of times we hit the ball over the net and they come back with a whole messy package to distract us and get us off our game from the essence of what we're really communicating. And at that moment, we have a choice. Do we take the bait, in effect? Or to use the gesture I did with our son with his younger sister, who would do stuff to provoke him, and then Forrest would react, and then parents would notice him, and then she'd get off scot-free, you know? I say, Forrest, man, she's got you, dude. Like a fish hooked with the bait. You took the bait, right? And he took the bait. The Buddha uses a great metaphor for that. He calls that the honeyed barb and the poisoned tip, you know? The honeyed tip and the poisoned barb. That's it, right? So instead, sometimes what is much more skillful is to kind of ignore all kinds of stuff and just keep going back to what you really want to deal with. And maybe that's the path of wisdom here. So something to think about. Great.
Rick, is use of humor at that moment a good screen? Because I was thinking about the timeliness. Recently, I gave feedback about an agreement that had not been kept, and I was feeling hot about it. And I found out that this other individual had multiple reasons for not following through, and I felt badly. But, you know, I think that a lot of the, you know, if I'd been able to use more humor at that moment in inquiry about it, that could have diffused a whole lot. It also gives a little bit of time for assessing where that individual really is, you know, and what's going to be hurtful in my most recent experience.
Yeah, I very much agree with you, and I'm just thinking again about what frees us up to be assertive. You know, do you know the metaphor of the tar baby? This is a African-American traditional story. Brother Rabbit is walking down the road and this tar baby in the bushes starts insulting him. Brother Rabbit's really angry at the tar baby, you know, so he hits him and now his fist is stuck to the tar baby. Tar baby starts really laughing. Brother Rabbit gets mad, kicks him, now his foot's stuck, hits him, kicks him, headbutts him. Now what has he got? You know, he's fully with, right, the tar baby. And so there's a kind of freedom where we allocate to ourselves unilaterally, I speak my piece, you do your thing, and then I still have a freedom. I'm not, in this language of psychology, stimulus bound to what comes across the net. What helps in that, of course, is to slow it down, reserve to your right the, you know, to yourself the right to do what Tara Brach calls the sacred pause, where you just take a moment to decide what you want to respond to and how. And what's nice about that is it's not being a doormat. It's actually being powerful and reserving to yourself the right, you know, to focus on what you want to focus on. I think about this very funny video or movie, Richard Pryor Live at the Sunset Strip. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's worth seeing, if only for this little part, that I think about a lot, where Richard Pryor, wonderfully talented African-American comedian, had been addicted to crack, cocaine. And at one time when he was smoking, his pipe blew up and he was very, very severely burned. And as he went through his own process of recovery, he moved out of the addiction. And then this was his first performance. So I'm not very good at acting and all that, but he had a moment where he was demonstrated his back and forth dialogue with Jim Brown, the very manly football player, you know, himself and friends. So Richard is basically doing this. He says to Jim, you know, hey, Jim, you want to get high, blah, 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 blah. You know, Jim Brown, and then Richard Pryor spins around, and he just has Jim Brown go, Richard, what you gonna do? You know, oh, Jim, don't give me all that attitude. Don't bug me so much. Hey, look at all that. Look at all this. You know, let's have some fun. Hey, let's go over there. You know, you don't need to do all that stuff. You know, it's Richard Pryor's just spinning out, creating a smoke screen. Jim Brown looks at him. Richard, what you gonna do? Oh, man, you know, you're like coming off like grandfather. You know, I want to tell you about my dad. He was a horrible guy. You know, he hit me all the time. You know, it was bad, 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 bad. Richard, what you gonna do? You know, just boom, 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 boom. And you finally get it. Like, there was a freedom in Jim Brown. He was not stimulus bound. He kept his eyes on the prize. I think often when we're dealing with other people, and for all kinds of reasons, we lose our sight of the prize. And I think that might be what you're zeroed in on. What's the larger prize here? What's the greater, what's the larger stake, you know, on the table here? Okay, yeah, please.
Yeah. Allow us more freedom. Assertiveness is because what I see is that it creates clarity. And when there's clarity, you don't have all that busyness in your own mind.
Yeah.
You can come down to really what's your truth and speak your truth, and that usually creates more truth.
Thank you. Yeah, exactly. Your mind's not clouded. You know, you're not being heedless. And yeah, exactly. Yeah, thank you for saying that. Maybe that's the 12th commandment, you know, don't take yourself so seriously, right? Or don't take it so personally. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, please.
The one about being helpful and the one about not harsh seems to me really hard to anticipate, because a lot of times when things go cattywampus, it's because there's a, you know, a blind spot, a really charged blind spot that you hit that you had no, you know, so it's very, ends up being very unhelpful to hit it, but you didn't know beforehand that you were going to hit it, so.
If just for everybody here and also for the recording, you know, so we want to speak in a way that's helpful, it's benevolent, leads to a good result, it's beneficial is the kind of word, beneficial, and also, we don't want to be too harsh. But on the other hand, sometimes in the moment, we're just triggered, right? We're plugged in. We have our finger in the socket, particularly if it's important stuff. And so to that a little bit, it makes me think of, what's the saying from Alcoholics Anonymous? That if you're hungry, angry, lonely, and tired?
Halt.
Yeah, exactly right. Hungry,
angry.
Hungry, angry, lonely, and tired. Someone explained that to me. So you're going into a situation, you know you're edgy. You know, and because you know you're edgy going in, the little voice or little alarm bell says, be especially careful. Right? Like if we're just walking on a flat surface, we don't have to be that super careful. But you're walking on the edge of a cliff or on very dangerous ground, then you really have to, you know, bring your A game to that. So that to me is one thing. And I think a second is to have fairly internalized some pretty strong commitments that even if you just won't go there. Like, you know, you could say all that stuff, I might want to hit you, I'm just not going to hit you. I don't hit people anymore. I really don't want to hit anybody. It doesn't arise even, but thank you very much. But you know what I mean? You just know to yourself, or the child, like the child's so provocative, but you just know in your heart, I'm just not going to use violence. That's it. Boom. So you have these rules. So there is a place for knowing what your rules are. And that's why there's a place where I call unilateral virtue. No matter what they do, you're not going to violate your code. Not because you're a chump and a doormat, for sure, moral reasons, benevolent reasons, but also because you realize that's how to really win. Because if you lose it, you violate the code, there might be a momentary gratification, but long term, you've just shot yourself in the foot. You've just hit those golf balls, ba-boom, and undermine your own moral credibility, undermine your authority. You don't look like the adult in the room, etc. So knowing what your own rules are, your own personal code, is really helpful. And that's where I think, for me at least, these guidelines have been very useful. Something I'm starting to look at lately is how we allow a certain harsh tone, how can I put it? We allow a certain harsh tone in emails or texts that we would not allow ourselves to use orally, on the phone or face-to-face. That's an interesting one. So it's to bring our own rules or internal admonitions to ourselves into all aspects of our life. So that to me is another one. And then if we slip, and we're going to slip, acknowledge it and undertake the training precept again. Okay, I got it. I'm learning from it. You know, one reason we undertake it is to learn from it. It doesn't mean we have to keep it perfectly. Oftentimes we learn a lot from our slips. Think about that. Yeah, please. And then a couple more minutes, we'll wrap up.
A little complicated, I'll try to remember. A friend had a problem with her cousin. She got a call from her, this friend got a call from her brother letting her know that her sister was dying. And the brother knows that her sister, and the other sister, the two sisters hadn't spoken since the 50s, about 20 years. And the woman who, I'm getting confused. The bottom line is that her cousin had called her to tell her that her sister was dying. And she already knew from her brother that her sister was dying. And the brother understood that those two had been estranged for a long time and also had seen what happened in the household. The older sister was dying. She was very brutal to the younger sister for many years. And so the brother didn't push her. And the cousin was appalled when my friend said, well, I'm not willing to talk to her. And she goes, well, she wants to make amends. And she says, well, tell her I blessed her and released her long ago, and we had an agreement 20 years ago that we were not going to talk anymore, because they had tried to make up, and the older sister kept up on the old brother. Well, the cousin was very dear to the woman, but the woman finally, the cousin just broke into screaming at her and saying, you're so controlling, you're so controlling. Now this cousin loves her sister, from what she told me. And I thought that this woman was in the right to hold her space. And she said, I'm not going to be, the woman said, I can't hear her voice because I still dream about the things she would say to me and how she treated me.
Yeah, I got it, yeah.
So I told my friend, I said, I think you're blessing her and releasing her and you don't wish her any harm. That's good. What do you think?
I think you've brought up a wonderful example. It's very messy, isn't it? I mean, it's easy.
The cousin, she called the cousin back twice, and all the cousin could scream at her both times, you're so controlling, you're so, and never listened to her. She said, I know you love your sister and you can't understand. It's very sad.
So I don't have the, you know, ultimate right answer, obviously. I'll just offer what I think are some guidelines that have worked for me from a practical standpoint, and I think are consistent with at least my understanding of, you know, the teachings of the Buddha. That's our framework here. The first is to really explore the question of, what do I owe you? What duties do I have to you? All right? To our children, let's say, or to those over whom we have power, you know, we have certain kinds of duties. Those duties are not necessarily the duties that we have to adults. And also, there's certain things that happen if, you know, again, people explore this for themselves. I mean this as an exploration. If we're in a relationship where you treat me well, I think I have greater duties to you than in a relationship between adults in which you treat me badly. See? So we can explore that. I had a situation very recently in a family where the biological father was, by all accounts, a narcissistic, sociopathic jerk. And he checked out really early. These three young children growing up in very difficult situations with an amazing mother who, after by the time the kids were around six, had remarried. And the stepdad, the man she married more exactly, did not have very strong inclinations toward fatherhood. He just wasn't in him. He just didn't have much feeling in that way. Good guy, I've met him. This is, everybody agrees, a good guy. But he just didn't have strong feelings toward fatherhood. Now, the biological father didn't have very strong feelings. He had probably no strong feelings toward fatherhood anyway, right? But compare the duties of the two men. The biological father clearly has duties to his children, including the duty to overcome his just disinterest in parenting, right? Whereas the new husband, you know, he doesn't have the same duties to those children. I think we would probably agree about that. So then you explore how you think about that and how you feel about that. But that's clearly an exploration of this notion of, what do I owe this other person? You know, maybe I owe you the restraint of not yelling back at you, but I don't owe you my time while you lambaste me and vent and run some kind of self-gratifying diatribe on me. Thank you for sharing. You explore. You see what I mean? The distinction there. And I think sometimes we can err either way. We can not appreciate the duties that we do have to other people. And then we wake up and we realize, we may feel some appropriate or healthy remorse. Or other times we feel like we have duties to people, to listen to them, to loan them money, or to, you know, agree with them just to keep the peace that we don't actually have. So that would be the first thing I would say about that. Second thing is to ask, what's in one's heart? There are all kinds of people who act well for the wrong reasons. And one of the fundamental teachings of the Buddha that was a breakthrough in his time was to focus not on behavior but intention. What's the intention behind the action? So if in one's heart, one realizes, you know, the way to really pay back that older sister, to really stick it to her, is to act very saintly, practicing noble silence, just letting it go, and being unreachable and available while, you know, just scratching your nose. Right? Like, what are the karmas of that? Those golf balls, those intentions. On the other hand, if a person in their heart, maybe they're a little awkward in the manifestation of it, but in their heart they realize, you know, I really do wish you well. But I also recognize that if I let you invade my mind and remain, using that phrase of the Buddha's, and especially pry your way back into those, you know, slots in my motherboard that you carved out through abusing your power over me as an older sibling and then the years ever since then, that's not good for the being among others who wears this name tag. So I'm going to protect this being. And it, you know, it's not good for other people, because if you invade my mind to remain, you know, that's going to have consequences for me. I'm going to be afflicted and I'm not going to have as much to offer to others. So I wish you well on the other side of the country. I'm over here. See, so the question is, what's in your heart about that? I'd say that. One last little thing. And it's to claim to ourselves the space to be compassionate for other people who are blaming us, right? Or accusing us falsely. That's a really tricky one. People are blaming us, or we think it's unfair accusations. They're being provocative, right? Or they're doing the classic thing of basically making their pain our fault somehow and trying to get in there. Where we have compassion for them while not feeling at fault whatsoever. I really wish you weren't suffering, and I don't feel one iota of responsibility for your suffering. I'm watching you pound yourself on the foot with your hammer. I don't agree with you that I'm at moral fault here. Just because you think I'm at fault doesn't mean I'm at fault. And I reserve the right to judge for myself what's true about that, while having compassion for you. Isn't that a sweet spot? And that's very centered and grounded. And I think one of the characteristics, to finish up here, of great teachers who are social activists, Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., people like that, is that for them to sustain their work, they have compassion for their impact on other people, let's say, including the people that they're trying to bring to justice, or who will have less because they're asserting their right to have more, right? They can have compassion for them while absolutely not taking on board one bit of what the other people are throwing at them. I'll finish on a gesture from a B movie that had an A-plus moment in the final scenes, North Dallas 40, which you may know it. It's about the Dallas Cowboys by their names. And the two main characters are, I believe, Nick Nolte, a young Nick Nolte, is a tight end. So he receives passes. And then the other main character is this charming quarterback. And they're really, really close friends. So the years go by, and Nolte wants to retire. He's done with football. And his quarterback friend and all the muckety-mucks, higher-ups, are trying to convince him to sign up again. And they're working him. The team needs you, right? The needs of others trump your own personal needs. Well, duties. What are my duties to my teammates? What are my duties to my aging body? And the guy who's wearing my name tag is going to crawl out of bed if he can 10 years from now, you know, because of the accumulating damage from one more year of playing in the National Football League. You know, who are my duties to, right? So the Nolte character, the tight end, just says, in the face of tremendous persuasive power, guilt tripping, inducements, money, all these fat cats in Texas want him to play again. He says, no, 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 no. His so-called best friend is complicit with these other people. No, 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 no. So then we're coming to boundaries. Nolte gets in the elevator, and his friend walks in the elevator flipping a football. Okay? And they've played catch for so many years and had such a great time. And Nolte himself, he's played catch a lot. You know, he's really, he loves the game. He loves playing catch, right? So they walk out to the sidewalk, the busy sidewalk of Dallas, right? And the final scene basically is that the quarterback character says, come on, man, just play one more season. It's fun. You know you love it. Here, come on, man, you know how good this is. Here, catch. And he throws the ball to Nolte. And it's kind of like slow motion. And you just know that if Nolte catches that ball, he's going to have taken the honeyed tip with the poison barb one more season. And you see his hands go up for it, right? He goes like this, and he just holds his hand like that. Wow. Goes like that. Ball hits his chest. Sorry, microphone. Hits his chest, bounces off, falls to the ground. And he walks away. I'm not going to take that on. That's yours. That's not mine. Yeah. I already got my hands full working out my own karmas here. Just feel the space of that? Yeah. He didn't hit his quarterback buddy. He didn't cross the line. He just, no mas. So on that profound note of Dharma, no mas. Let's sit for a minute. Thank you very much. And thank you again, Tarne,
yeah,
for that party. September 7th.